I'm gonna keep, I was in the middle of a big calculation, calculating the quantum fluctuations generated during inflation. And I think it's nice to do this calculation in two gauges. There's the spatially flat gauge. Where the trace of the space-based part of the metric is zero, and so is the divergence obtained by contracting with one derivative. And then there's the so-called unitary gauge, where I have to correct an error that I made last time. I wrote the definition of this gauge down incorrectly. So the real definition is that you've gauged away the fluctuations in the phi field, and the space-based part of the metric should satisfy this condition. So that corrects last time. I got a little confused by my own notation, which is maybe a little too streamlined. Anyway, the idea of this odd-looking condition is that if the metric is a scalar function times delta ij, then the gauge condition is satisfied. All right. Now, we sort of argued on the basis of counting degrees of freedom that it ought to be possible to bring an arbitrary set of fluctuations into either of these gauges. A gauge transformation is parameterized by a scalar alpha and a three-vector beta. So if I have a gauge condition with one scalar and one three-vector being set to zero, I ought to be able to fit a free scalar and a free vector to the scalar and vector conditions. But I'm going to show that explicitly just to... Sometimes it's useful to actually find the explicit form of the gauge transformation that goes from one gauge to another. I'll actually use this formula later. So let's show explicitly. And I also want an excuse to illustrate something called the SVT decomposition, which is really useful for calculations. I'll do it in detail in one example, and then I'll tend to just summarize in the future what you get, because it's sort of straightforward once you've done it once. So let's show explicitly that an arbitrary metric can be put into spatially flat gauge. Via gauge transformation alpha beta. I'm using the notation in the notes on the wiki where the gauge transformation like this is the four vector is split up into an alpha and a beta. By the way, a bunch of formulas that I'm going to use are on the formula sheet on the wiki, and I just posted a new formula sheet, that has some of the more recent stuff from the more recent lectures. Okay, so from the formula sheet, from a previous lecture, under a gauge transformation, the trace of the metric, the thing we want to set to zero, transforms like this. And this divergence-like quantity transforms like this. Now, for an arbitrary initial metric, these could be an arbitrary scalar function and an arbitrary vector function. So if I let's temporarily call this one S and this one VI. We want to show that for an arbitrary pair of sources, S and V, for arbitrary sources, S and VI, we can solve these equations of S and And so I'm going to solve those equations using what's called the SVT decomposition, which means that you write the equations in Fourier space, and then just one Fourier mode at a time. You decompose in the helicity, under helicity, or rotation around the axis of the wave vector k. SVT stands for scalar vector tensor, but a better name would be helicity decomposition. Okay, so first step is to go to Fourier space. So that just converts the derivatives to algebraic operations. So for each Fourier mode k, I have now an algebraic set of equations. Sign is minus, right? Yeah. K squared beta I equals VI. All right. And now to helicity or SVT decompose. That just means every field that enters into the equation that has indices, you decompose into like longitudinal and transverse components. So here we just have vectors. So for a vector, for each vector vi, I just decompose it as a, these are linear equations, so I work one Fourier mode at a time. I've suppressed the k arguments to the alpha and beta, but I can just pretend that the whole universe is one Fourier mode. This is all at one value of k. So I just write vi as a piece, a longitudinal piece, which is parallel to k. Convenient to put the I here to cancel the I's from the Fourier transform, plus a transverse piece. Where this VI perpendicular. Where VI perpendicular is just the part of the vector perpendicular to k. Then if I plug those in, I get some simpler equations. So here when I plug in beta, I just kill off the transverse part, beta perpendicular, and you just keep, in this case, plus k, right? Yeah, plus k, beta perpendicular equal to s. And then when I plug in here, let's see, in the first piece, I just generate a longitudinal part. So get a VIHK. When I put the longitudinal part in here, I'll get another longitudinal piece. I over two. Okay.
Should that be a hat on the where of pi of ki equals zero? Down there.
Oh, here?
Yeah.
Oh, it wouldn't matter because they just differ by a factor of the absolute value of k, and it's zero on the right hand side. Plus one over two. This piece also gives plus I over two. And then when I put the transverse piece in, the transverse part of beta and this part dies, And this part is still transverse. And when I did this, I just plugged in so all I did in this step is plug in for beta and v, the vectors decomposed into this form. And then I'll take the pieces, I organize the answer in advance so that the longitudinal part of the left-hand side would be separated from the transverse side part, and likewise on the right-hand side. So then the next step is to just separate out the longitudinal and transverse parts of what you get here to sort of decompose the second equation into a longitudinal and transverse part. And so that gives, so the longitude, so you can think of that as being two equations, this longitudinal piece and this transverse piece. Perpendicular. And now the equations have been put in their SVT form, where they look algebraic, and there's also no sort of funny indexology with k hat. So if I pair off this equation, if I pair this equation with this one, it's just a straightforward system of two equations and two unknowns that I can solve for alpha and beta parallel. Beta longitudinal. And then this, of course, is just trivial to read off beta perpendicular. So this decomposition is kind of using up the last bit of symmetry that remains. In general, if a set of equations are translation invariant, you're probably better off using that translation invariance by Fourier transform lemma. And if the equations are also linear, then the Fourier transformed equations will all be algebraic equations that apply one k vector at a time. And in a universe with a k vector, there's still a residual rotational symmetry, a helicity around the axis. So now it's easy to combine. Now it's straightforward to solve and read off the gauge transformation. And beta perpendicular is minus 2 over k squared perpendicular. And putting back here, S and V were just short abbreviations for the HAI that you had in the original metric and its divergence. So you could shorten this. Well, let's see. I guess V, well, let's just leave them in that form. I'll just leave them in that form. Okay. So by the way, I wrote down the SVT decomposition. So the key thing defining the SVT decomposition is this decomposition of a vector VI into longitudinal and transverse pieces. And sometimes you have a tensor. So if I had, here I started with a vector equation and a tensor equation, or, sorry, a scalar and a vector. But if I had a tensor, for a symmetric tensor, the SVT decomposition is I would take every tensor quantity entering the equations and write it as a sum of a trace. Let's call it Sij. There'd be a trace part. A longitudinal part. This is just the trace-free part that's invariant under the helicity rotation. There's a mixed part, for lack of a better term, which I'll write like this. Where here the S has one index, and has to give zero when you contract with k hat. Otherwise, you would put the part that the component in the k direction into the longitudinal part. And this does have trace zero, plus a fully transverse piece. Which satisfies this. This is for a symmetric tensor. So for example, the gauge conditions for the spatially flat gauge just say that the trace part is zero, and then if I get zero when I contract with ki, then both the longitudinal and mixed parts have to be zero. So the metric would just have this piece to it. As another example, generally speaking, the anisotropic stress tensor pi ij that we defined is a traceless symmetric tensor, but otherwise arbitrary. I mean, this is zero in single field inflation, but in other situations it could be non-zero, and then this piece would be absent.
I'm sorry, the traceness is somewhat maybe there are two indices ij being some node over.
Oh yeah, sorry, there should be no index on the.
Is this just the trace, or is this 1/n times the trace?
I usually define it like this. It's just a convention.
No, I mean, like, how do I calculate ST? Is that just the trace of Sij, or is it?
Oh, okay, so ST, the way that I define it here, it would be 1 over n
okay,
times delta ij, Sij.
Thanks.
All right. So let's play with Einstein's equations in the spatially flat gauge. So I think the spatially flat gauge is the gauge where Einstein's equations look the simplest. So first, if you look at Einstein's equations for the perturbed FRW metric in the formula sheet, then you'll see that two of Einstein's equations look like this. So I'm taking some. So the important thing about these equations is that they are not going to have time derivatives. Now the full equations in a general gauge do have time derivatives. But it turns out that for two of the Einstein equations, if I set the terms to zero, which are zero in the spatially flat gauge, then I end up with equations that don't have time derivatives. Since there are no time derivatives on the left-hand side, then this is something that's only true in spatially flat gauge. Einstein's equations, so metric degrees of freedom A and B are just non-dynamical quantities that are given by algebraic equations in terms of the stress energy. So you can solve these equations, this pair of equations, for A and B, given the stress energy. And the way that you would do that is just by the same procedure, using this SVT procedure. So I just just take these equations and convert the spatial derivatives to IKs, and then separate the equations out into their longitudinal transverse parts for at a given value of k. The answer that you get, let me do one intermediate step and just write out what you will get when you SVT. The first equation will read like this. Maybe I'll give this as a homework problem. The SVT procedure is really mechanical once you get do a couple of examples. And you can trivially, I think this equation is probably behind the podium where not all of you can see it. These equations are easy to solve to give the following formulas for A and B. I think really the important thing about the formulas is just that they show that the A and B components of the metric are non-dynamical in spatially flagged. Maybe perpendicular. Okay. So the equations of motion, so to speak, for these components of the metric are just constraint equations. Since A and B are non-dynamical, and most of H has been set to zero by the gauge conditions, then the only part of the metric that hasn't been determined or analyzed yet is the only part of the metric that's left is the thing that I called before the transverse traceless part of H in SVT language. To analyze that, let's look at this Einstein equation. So there's an Einstein equation that looks like this in spatially flat gauge. By the way, you might wonder why. So this is the third Einstein equation that I've written down, and it's going to be enough to figure out what the transverse traceless part of the metric is doing. You might wonder why there are four Einstein equations if I only needed three of them to completely solve for the metric. And the reason is that, generally speaking, contained in Einstein's equations is the fact that the stress energy tensor is conserved. And that's sort of a condition on the matter that is sourcing gravity, that Einstein's equations demands that the matter satisfy in order for general relativity to be mathematically consistent. So for example, and this was a homework problem, single field slow roll equation, this is just equivalent to the equation of motion for the inflaton. So in a specific example, like single field slow roll inflation, two of Einstein's equations will sort of be redundant. They'll be encoding the equation of motion of the inflaton or something that's just true of the stress energy. Or let's say this is 4 out of 10 of Einstein's equations. The remaining Einstein's equations, well, some of them will be, redundant with each other
given a specific choice of gauge condition. But the Einstein equations that remain will determine the metric. So that's why we didn't have to use all of them. Okay, so I didn't finish writing this out. So the Einstein equation read like this, where Lij is this tensor. So if I just take under the this is a relation between symmetric traceless tensors. So under the SVT decomposition, it would have a longitudinal part, a purely longitudinal part, a mixed part, and a purely transverse part, transverse traceless part. If I just take the transverse traceless part, then most of the terms go away. So if you fit transverse traceless part, you could fully decompose it, SVT decompose it. And then you'd get like an equation for the longitudinal part, which would turn out to be redundant with the other Einstein equations, assuming that stress energy is conserved. But the transverse traceless part contains the equation of motion for the transverse traceless part of the metric. I get this, HIJ perpendicular, say inverse. Which shows that the transverse traceless part of the metric obeys a second order wave equation, which is sourced by the transverse traceless part of the stress energy. So if there's anisotropic stress, it generates new gravity waves. Otherwise, the gravity waves just kind of oscillate and redshift away if the right-hand side is zero. So that's the general equation of motion for H. By the way, this equation, we didn't show it, but this equation is actually gauge invariant. It would take the same form in any gauge. And so in spatially flat gauge, so the transverse traceless part of HIJ is dynamical. It satisfies a wave equation. And because the other components besides the transverse traceless part of the metric are zero in spatially flat gauge, this is actually the equation of motion for the whole metric. So in spatially flat gauge, just to count the degrees of freedom, the counting of degrees of freedom is really transparent. It is transparent. A and B are just non-dynamical quantities. They're just different names for the stress energy. The trace, the longitudinal, and the mixed part of the metric are just zero by the gauge condition. The transverse traceless part of the metric is dynamical. It satisfies a wave equation. Just the wave equation for gravitational waves in an expanding universe sourced by anisotropic stress. Finally, you have some whatever matter fields. We're in the action. In the case of inflation, the inflaton phi. So this is this counting of degrees of freedom is what you expect should happen in general relativity. You're just adding two spin two degrees of freedom to the degrees of freedom that you had before, as you might expect, since general relativity is supposed to be the theory of a massless spin two particle. Okay. Now, actually, everything that I said here on these blackboards is specific to the spatially flat gauge, but doesn't have anything to do with inflation. So now let's specialize and see what things look like. You might think that the spatially flat gauge is so simple and intuitively appealing that there'd be no reason to use any other gauge. But the reason that's not true is because it just tends to be a big mess. It just tends to involve a lot of algebra. So for example, if you think about, I'll write all of this out in a bit, but if you think about what the equation of motion for phi would look like in the spatially flat gauge. So first we had a big mess last time we had the equation of motion of the inflaton that we would want to specialize. Actually, I guess I'll write it down. Sorry, I've got a lot of paperwork up here. Okay, so we had, by the way, I haven't really been reminding you as I've gone along. I mean, so we've derived some equations that are true in any gauge and some equations that are true in a specific gauge, some equations that are true for single field inflation and others that are true more generally. So I hope it's been clear which equations are true in what generality. Anyway, here's this equation was the equation of motion for the inflaton in an arbitrary gauge. And the spatially flat gauge isn't helping too much in setting terms to zero. It zeros this term, but the others remain. So to sort of unravel this, I would need A and B. And so here are some formulas that are true in the spatially flat gauge, but not true. But don't require inflation. We'd solve the constraints for A to find that given by these expressions. B parallel is the divergence of B that appears here is just minus KB parallel in the SVT notation. So we plug these in here. But we still need to plug in, to close the system of equations, we still need to plug in things for the stress energy. So we need to use that for inflation. Delta rho is we had a formula for delta rho. And so when I combine all of these formulas, you can plug them all into each other. And at the end of the day, you'll have a wave equation for phi for delta phi with only delta phi's appearing, just some closed, you know, self-contained differential equation for delta phi. But it's kind of a big mess. Let me give this a name and call this the scalar sector mess. We'll come back and disentangle that mess. So that's the reason why the spatially flat gauge is usually not very convenient. It just tends to involve a lot of algebra. Oh, wait, where? I'm so impressed that you're...
Blackboard?
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, first line.
It's a term on the right-hand side. Phi bar dot squared a dot minus dot.
Sorry, say that one more time.
The term in the top equation that's phi dot bar squared bracket a dot minus a inverse blah, 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 blah.
Right. It should just be a...
Is it meant to be a square or a no square? Because it was different yesterday.
Oh, let's look at my notes. You're right, no square. Wow. I'm seriously impressed that you guys noticed that. All right.
Seriously paying attention. The equation of motion for the gravity waves and signal field soral inflation, of course, is just this wave equation that we had before with zero on the right-hand side because there's no anisotropic stress for gravity waves. The next thing I'm going to do is analyze. This is pretty simple. So let's analyze and find the quantum fluctuations in the gravitational wave sector. So if I switch to conformal time, then I can write this. Each time derivative becomes A inverse times a conformal time derivative. This is the Mukunov-Sasaki equation. When I wrote it down before, I called the scale factor 0 to allow for the possibility. That the expansion history appearing in the evolution of the mode was not the same as the real expansion history of the universe. But here that doesn't happen. Z is just equal to A. You'll remember in our discussion of the Mukunov-Sasaki equation, it was sort of useful to think about two quantities. There was a quantity that there's always a quantity that freezes at late times. And so with the Mukunov-Sasaki equation written this way, then the quantity that appears in the equation is the thing that freezes at late times. So the gravity waves freezes after horizon crossing. The canonically normalized quantity would just be A times that. So this is the quantity which behaves as a harmonic oscillator at early, before horizon crossing. So we know for the before. Now, we had an analysis of this equation that told us, in particular, gave us an approximation that was true in the slow roll limit. for the behavior of the mode function at late times. So since we have that equation here, we're almost done. The only thing that is needed is to get the normalization from the action. So we need the normalization of the mode function. And for that, you really do have to go back to the action. The overall normalization is lost if all you have is the classical equation of motion. And so this was actually a little unexpected. So what we need, you might think that this appears to require computing the action to second order, which would be kind of a long calculation. About as long as deriving the Einstein's equations. But it's not so bad. Here we just need, all we need to know is the conjugate momentum to plug into a commutator. And so we just need, all we need are terms with two time derivatives. On Hij perpendicular. And there I found there are some kind of high-tech tricks that can help you if you want to expand an action to second order. But for just keeping track of these terms, I actually found it easy to just sort of go back to basics and just start writing out Christoffel symbols. Keeping terms. Yeah, okay, great. Okay. And just thinking about which terms could contain two time derivatives. So, starting with the Christoffel symbols, I looked at the formula sheet, and there, so the Christoffel symbols are either going to get squared or differentiated when they go into R. So we need to keep all the Christoffel symbols that have one time derivative. And those Christoffel symbols are this one. I found two. This isn't the whole thing. I'm just keeping the part of the Christoffel symbol with the time derivative on the Hij. These were the Christoffel symbols that had an H time derivative. I'll put you up here. So now if you just kind of go through the, next up is the Ricci tensor. Let's see, I went through this guy and found that here I could get there's a minus sign in front, and then I could get a minus 2 h dot jk h dot. Why did I think that? Oh, I'm sorry, I left off. My notes are a little disorganized. I left off another term here that appears to second order. Jeez, this should really be in the... I don't know why this didn't make it into my notes. There's another term that appears at second order here when you raise the Christoffel symbol in the metric using the perturbed metric. And something doesn't seem... Because I have to admit, I'm having difficulty understanding my own notes here. Okay. Why don't I get a term with a second derivative there? All right. Maybe. I'm sure I'm missing something obvious. Let me just. Somehow I got tripped up in my own notes, and they don't quite make sense to me. Let me just sort it out overnight and come back to this later. So sorry for that gap. Somehow the wrong... Remember when I was making the notes, I screwed the calculation up and then did it right, and somehow the wrong version of the calculation made it into the notes. Okay, so let's say some dot, dot, dots that I won't try to fill in real time, but are, I promise I'll fill in tomorrow, and they won't be any big deal. At the end of the day, you should get this to second order. Then a squared. And I went ahead and converted to conformal time. Okay. Now, to normalize the mode functions, I should tell you about the cosmologist convention. So, the cosmologist convention is to for each wave number k, you define two basis tensors like this. And I'm not sure why the 1/4 as opposed to some number that's not so small. And to define these numbers, h plus and h cross, to be the amplitudes of the gravity wave. So if I plug in, so each of these quantities, h plus, would obey the Mukunov-Sasaki equation. So in these variables, the action reads, when I contract each of these basis tensors with itself, I get a 1/8. So the conjugate momenta If I were to define a conjugate momentum for H plus by differentiating the action with its conformal time derivative, then I would get m Planck squared over 8 a squared plus del t. And likewise for the other component. Okay, so just to make this totally concrete, to calculate the mode functions for the gravity waves, we would integrate this differential equation. With normalization, given by setting the canonical commutator to I, this is m Planck squared over 8, so u prime used. Now, so that's a complete prescription for the mode function. You just square the mode function at tau equals 0 to get the power spectrum. If we want to use our slow roll approximation for the answer, then if we want to go back and compare with what we had before, before when we talked about a canonically normalized scalar field, we had the same equation of motion, but this factor was equal to 1. So the mode functions will just be down by root 8 over m Planck squared relative to what we have before, which means that the power spectrum of each of these numbers, h plus and h minus, has an 8 over m Planck squared relative to the answer that we got before. This prefactor was 1 previously. Where this is an approximation. Where the star means evaluated at the time of horizon crossing. Okay. So this is a really fundamental result. This is the power spectrum of the gravity waves produced by inflation, approximated in the slow roll approximation. But of course, you could just integrate the exact equations of motion if you wanted to compute it to arbitrary accuracy. It's almost scale invariant. Why almost? Scale invariant would mean that the power spectrum is proportional to 1 over k cubed. Here, h star is a decreasing function during inflation, a decreasing function of time. So this power spectrum does, after multiplying by k cubed, does decrease with k, but slowly, because in the slow roll approximation, h is a part of the slow roll approximation says that h doesn't change very much in the Hubble time. So one thing that is always true in inflation is that inflation predicts a red power spectrum. Namely, the power spectrum is scale invariant, has a scale invariant form times k to the minus epsilon, where epsilon is greater than 0. So it has a little more power on large scales than scale invariant. a blue power spectrum, a positive sign here, would be one of the few things that we could observe in the future that would really kind of rule out inflation. It's hard to see how you could ever accommodate. That would suggest this formula for the gravity waves is kind of all there is to it. At least with scalar fields, maybe if you added fields to the spin helicity 2 sector by putting in fundamental tensor fields during inflation, maybe that would be a way to break this. Anyway, if the graviton is the only spin 2 thing that's important during inflation, then I think this is a totally generic prediction. And a blue spectrum would mean that H dot was positive, which doesn't make physical sense and is sort of forbidden anyway for any reasonable stress energy tensor. The technical thing that breaks is what's called the null energy condition. The size of the gravity waves as a dimensionless strain is parametrically, let's say strain just so it's clear, is parametrically H over M Planck. So detection of gravity waves would translate directly to a measurement of H or equivalently the energy density during inflation. The current upper limit from the CMB says that this is less than about 10 to the minus 9. It'll improve soon. We'll push this down by several orders of magnitude in the not too distant future, depending on what your ideas of naturalness during inflation may or may not make a big difference. I mean, one way of thinking about it is that if you think of inflation as sort of taking place on a random potential, then you have to tune things to keep the observed scalar modes at the right level and bring the gravity waves orders of magnitude below this. You have to tune things quite a bit. Roughly what has to happen is that the inflaton has to start off at the top of a hill. On the other hand, if you think of inflation as being associated with sort of a fundamental energy scale, then roughly what the current bounds say is that inflation must have happened at roughly the gut scale or below, like a factor of 10 to the minus 4, say below M Planck is the gut scale. And even say a factor of 10 to the 4 improvement in this would only increase the limit on H to a couple of orders of magnitude below the gut scale. And since we have no idea what physics is between, say, the TeV scale and the gut scale, inflation could have happened anyway, then maybe it's sort of unlikely that we'll see gravity waves. There's sort of two camps that like sort of debate over which scenario is fine-tuned and which scenario is not. Anyway, pretty soon we'll make the measurement and we'll know the answer. I won't have time in the class to talk about alternatives to inflation. There are other models of the early universe, non-inflationary expansion histories, that also generate the right quantum mechanical fluctuations. And as far as I know, there's like sort of 5 different families now. As far as I know, inflation is the only one that can ever predict a detectable level of gravity waves. So if this is seen in the CMB, then I think almost everyone would interpret it as a real smoking gun that inflation is the correct theory of the early universe.
Doesn't this granularly depend on the square root of the frequency or something, or is this for specific wavelengths at the during inflation?
Is
this 10 to the minus 21 divided by a square root of millihertz or whatever that thing?
Oh, I see. Okay.
This actually is the perturbation in the metric. So if the metric is some unperturbed part times 1 plus 2 HAJ. So if you wanted to know about the, say, the energy transported by the gravity wave, which has like 2 spatial derivatives in it, then you would add a factor of k squared.
Okay.